Welcome to Family Matters, the Adoption UK podcast. My name is Sarah and I'm your host. And in this episode, I'm joined by Simon Benn. Simon, I think it's best if you introduce yourself.
Thank you. Yeah. So I'm 58. I live up in the north, live in a tiny little village called Huntingdon, which is kind of between Leeds, York, around Wetherby, that area. Okay. I was adopted 58 years ago from the Lancashire and Cheshire Adoption Council, I think it was called, in Liverpool. That was very early February 1967. I was born in January.
Okay.
67. And yeah, so I live in this village called Huntingdon now with my wife and the two dogs, and I'm a podcaster and a trainer.
Okay. Basically. That's interesting. Everyone's got a podcast now, haven't they?
Everybody's got a podcast, yeah. Well, yeah, and if you're listening and you fancy doing one, then just kind of get on, do it. There's a lot of people make it a lot more complicated than it is.
And can I say that yours is called Thriving Adoptees, isn't it?
It's called Thriving Adoptees.
And you can find that on your website, which is thrivingadoptees.com.
.com, yeah.
Right. Tons and tons of interesting conversations on there, and all of them around the theme of adoption.
All around the theme of adoption, all around the theme of thriving and healing and learnings. Okay. So most adoption podcasts are about stories. Thriving Adoptees is about learning and what the people that I interview have learned about what helps us thrive as us, as human beings, as adoptees, as adopted parents, as adoption professionals. Where is it? What's that guest learned? You know, people, I use the word wisdom and some people are too modest. Like, you know, modest wisdom. You're calling me wise, Simon. Well, yeah, I am.
So interesting that you should start there, because we're going to explore a bit more about what's brought you here to this point in your life. But I would like to start by asking you about a project that you are working on right now.
Yeah.
It's a book. And it's a book that you would like help from our listeners with.
That's right. Could
you tell me a bit about what that book is and who it's for?
So the book is for adoptive parents, and I'm not an adoptive parent. I'm not a parent. However, I'm an adoptee, and adoptees have stuff to share, really. So I'm crowdsourcing the content for the book. So what that means is I'm asking people from across the adoption constellation what they would like to share with adopted parents, what wisdom that they've got that they'd like to share with the with adoptive parents. And so I'm taking all those contributions and those suggestions, and I'm going to set them out according to a Thrive framework that I've developed. So in the podcast is about the guest's wisdom, and this book is about the contributors to the book's wisdom. What I'm doing is extending the wisdom network, if you like.
Okay. So you are gathering, you want to gather all this wealth of wisdom.
Correct.
A lot of it, well, most of it, hard-learned wisdom, would you say?
Yes.
Learned at the cold face of life.
Yes, indeed. From the tough stuff, right? We learn far more from the tough stuff than we do from when everything's going peachy and rosy. It's in those darker moments that our biggest learnings and our biggest shifts, our biggest insights happen. So one of the key things is for me, the big changes, the big insights, the big epiphany moments, the big aha moments, that's what's changed my world.
Okay.
So I know that's what changed other people's worlds as well. So yeah, that's what we're gathering, hard-earned wisdom.
So you want to hear from anyone with personal professional experience of adoption, is that right?
So
adoptees,
adoptive parents,
yeah,
adoption professionals, birth parents, and people that wear more than one of those hats.
Okay. So you're going to gather their wisdom together, share it with adoptive parents. And what is your ambition for what that book will do?
Help adoptive parents help their kids thrive.
So talking about wisdom, what for you have been those sort of moments where life has taught you, you know, the most impactful lessons?
Yeah. So there's two huge moments for me in terms of adoption stuff. So at 40, so my mum and dad told me that I was adopted before I was so young, but I can't remember ever not knowing. Apparently it was on my second birthday, and on my second birthday I was with in the car with my mum and dad driving back over from Yorkshire back to Lancashire, where we collected a baby sister, right? So she's not biologically related to me.
Okay.
So when I was 40, on my 40th birthday, my mum and dad came round to pick me and my wife up to take us to the pub for dinner. And my mum brought a box of stuff that I'd left behind in my childhood bedroom, right, when I moved out when I was 22. And included in that box was a teddy bear. And my father told my wife that sometime that night that the teddy bear was from my birth mother. And my wife told me. And my first reaction was a kind of gentle curiosity. Oh, that's a bit strange. They told me that I was adopted. Clearly, you know, the fact that this teddy bear is from my birth mum. Why didn't they tell me that? And my mum says that they did tell me that, right? But I can't remember. Mm. So my first reaction, my initial reaction was this gentle curiosity. And then a couple of weeks later, I was talking to a trainer I was talking to a trainer about anger, and found myself, my anger, right? And I found myself talking about sharing the story of the teddy bear. And these words came out of my mouth that I'd never thought before, never said before. She didn't love me enough to keep me. So what's the teddy bear? A consolation prize. But there was a lot of swearing and kind of violence behind those words. And, you know, I hadn't been consciously aware of any trauma growing up. I had felt connected to my mum and dad. I felt that they were my mum and dad. There was no questioning. A lot of adoptees question, want to know stuff about their birth parents, especially the birth mothers, as their kids growing up. I didn't have any of that. I was, to use the, I think the jargon, securely attached.
Okay. And can I just ask you about, just to go back to the teddy bear. So your parents had obviously at some point told you where the bear had come from.
Well,
and you were little and you'd forgotten it, and they just assumed that you'd remembered, or what do you think happened there?
Memories can play tricks on us, right?
Yeah.
So if they did tell me, it didn't land.
Yeah. Is there a lesson there for adoptive parents, do you think, about not always assuming that information you think you've passed on has landed, that there is a place for going back over things? And
It definitely seems so. I'd say that's a valid.
Yeah.
I'd say that's right. And in life, right? Not just with our kids, in life. You know, I took over part of the family business in 1995, and I had a small team between four, five, six of us between 1995 and 2011 when I got out of the business. And I would assume that once I told somebody something that it had landed, but it often hadn't. And so assuming makes an ass of you and me is the little thing that people say. So
yeah, and it can be so easy to fall into that trap, can't it? That, like, it's in my head and I think I've told you, so it must be in your head as well, in the same way. It's in my head. And that is, you know, it's a big lesson for us growing up, isn't it, that perspective, you know.
Yeah,
everybody has different perspective on stuff.
Yeah, different things land for different people different ways. There's a lot about that tone, the tone. It's not just, I've done a lot of looking around this sort of stuff in terms of communication. People say that communication is the response you get, right? So it's as us, we can take responsibility for how we communicate. So one little thing I heard about that is, rather than saying, have you understood that? Take the ownership back on me. Have I explained that well?
Yeah.
What do you mean? So yeah. It's about us being proactive, leading, you know, whether we're leading a business or whether we're leading our child, team, whatever. Yeah,
it's really interesting. It's we're wandering off topic slightly here, but I was looking at some frustration in real life a few months ago. I was in a queue to get on the Eurostar, and there was a lot of staff really cross with the general, with their customers, because they weren't queuing in the right way or getting in the right funnel or whatever. And I just kept thinking, as a communications person myself, you haven't communicated that. People are doing their best, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean,
you need to look at your instructions.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. We're all doing the best that we can all the time. So it's about grace for others.
Yeah, and a bit of humility. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, I derailed you. What you were saying there about the teddy bear. So that had sort of come as a shock. Is that too strong a word to say about that bear was shocking?
Well, the initial reaction wasn't a shock. It was kind of gentle curiosity, but then it changed.
Yeah.
And in the context of a conversation about anger, then this anger came out of me, you know. And as you know, as soon as I said it, the coachy type counselor woman that I was talking to, Sarah, said, well, I don't think... I'm a mum, Simon, and I don't think it would have been quite like that. And I saw her wisdom then, right? So this was a new thought to me. She didn't love me enough to keep me. The new thought was met with her reaction, which was, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's correct, Simon. So in a way, you could say she invalidated me.
Right.
But she was correct, right?
Yeah.
She was correct. Now, because it was a new thought, it wasn't particularly bedded in. It wasn't a belief. So it shifted. It shifted in that moment, in her, you know, my response to her response. Whereas if it had been a belief, if I'd been thinking for 40 years that, or whatever it was, when do we have kind of conscious thought in words and stuff, maybe since I was five, right? Four or five. If I'd been thinking my birth mother didn't love me enough to keep me for 30, you know, if I'd been having that thought for 35 years, it would be a lot more embedded, and therefore it would take a lot more uprooting.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I guess that's about the stories we tell ourselves, isn't it? And how much we should trust those stories.
Yeah. I mean, people say all the time that, you know, we've got to share our stories. Yes. And also, I guess we have to question our stories.
Yeah.
Because so probably 6 months after, 6 months, a year, maybe so after having that moment when I saw this unconscious trauma for the first time, I went on a course, a kind of a retreat thing. Two people leading it, six of us on it. I was the only adoptee there. And we all shared it's a 5-day retreat. For the first 3 days, basically, all we did was share our stories and how we'd felt about our stories. And all of us realized that the stories, a lot of our stories were untrue, especially the story that we all shared, which was a not good enough story. Everybody has, you know, people call it imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has a voice in their head. Everybody has an inner critic. It's just from what I've learned doing the podcast, adoptees have a supercharged version.
Okay.
So they've got a supercharged version of the inner critic.
That inner critic. So in that retreat then, coming to the realization that some of the stories we keep repeating about ourselves.
Yeah, it is a loop.
Yeah.
It is a loop.
And do you think they get reinforced every time we tell them? And, you know, they're never the same, are they? They develop a bit, they get more entrenched. And we, you know, there's this thing, isn't there, about we're the sort of heroes of our own stories. And that can't be true.
Well, the heroes, I don't think we are the heroes of our own story. I think we paint ourselves as the villains of our own story.
Do you mean, when you say that, do you mean adoptees specifically?
No, I mean all human beings.
All human beings.
And I totally agree, it gets more entrenched.
Yeah.
And we, the inner critic grows as we grow older. And what we did on that retreat was disidentify from the inner critic. We saw that the inner critic was a liar.
Yeah, and something separate from you.
Yeah, so I came up with a way of explaining this a couple of weeks ago, which I thought was pretty cool, really, because it's like, are we the voice in our head, or are we the one that hears it?
Okay.
Right? So as far as I can see it, the there are only two options there. Would you agree? Can you see a third option?
No, interesting. I've been thinking a bit about this lately. I think I'm a very similar age to you, Simon. So maybe we're at similar points in our life. I'm not sure, but that I've become much more aware of my inner critic and who that is. And sometimes I can picture who that person is that's saying those things. It's definitely not me. And I can sort of see where they come from. Sometimes it's sort of a preachy older man, you know, who sort of used to put the fear of God into me when I was a child. And I can see those people now, and it's much easier to go, yeah, I know who you are, and you're a charlatan, and I'm not listening to you anymore. And I know I'm much more closely aligned with my voice. But it could all be a big illusion. I don't know.
Well, yeah. So as we're talking about this now, I'll address what you just said about the different, you know, the members of the committee, shall we say. I'm not a big committee fan. I thought I was really grown up. I was a school governor when I was 30, in my 30s, and I thought this was really good, and I was a really grown up. But I just couldn't hack the committee. The committee ways, right? But anyway, so we are the voice in our head, or the one that hears it, right? And I thought, I was thinking about this, how do I make this clearer, right? So because as a trainer, I'm all the time, I'm trying to think of how I can make my message clearer based on truth. And we can hear before we can speak. So hearing comes first, words come later, speaking comes later. So we must be the voice in our head. Sorry, we must be the listener. We must be the hearing. We must be the hearer rather than the speaker, because, you know, people talk about babies being born with only two fears. One, the fear of loud noises, and two, the fear of falling backwards, right? So fear of loud noises, right? So clearly the baby can hear, but the baby has no words, and the voice in our head is words. So it must be, it seemed to me for quite a while, one of those chicken and egg things. Am I the chicken or am I the egg? Which came first, or am I chicken or the egg? But
yeah,
you know, a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, it's right, well, we hear before we have words. So hearing must be primary. Our words must be secondary. The voice in our head is made of words. So that was kind of my logic around that. And and we have, going to your point about the grumpy old man, you know, we have picked up the words in our heads. We have picked them up from other people.
Yeah,
we have picked them up from other people. And there's an approach, in a therapeutic approach, called internal family system. Now, that came from looking within a family, right? The system of a family. But then the guy who created it, a guy called Dick Schwartz, realized that the system is the person, and we've got, there's different parts of us that correspond with our different ages. So when you say you heard this stern voice from this grumpy kind of Victorian granddad kind of guy, right? So that's you, that particular part of your voice, that particular part of the voice in your head is associated with how old you were when you heard that on board, when you took that on board. And what the psychologists would say is that we'd call this conditioning. So it's what we learn about the world from others, you know. So we learn that, my favorite example of this, because it's absolutely nuts, yeah, everybody thinks it's true, including me, right? Is what we learn from the rest of the people in our lives is that we learn about miserable weather. So there's this idea that's handed down from generation to generation that rain makes us miserable, right? Miserable weather. This is miserable weather. I go to the swimming pool. I ask the lady on reception, how are you doing? And before she answers the question, I've asked her how she is. Before she answers my question, she looks out the window to see what the weather's doing to allow her to respond to me.
Oh, dear. I'm terribly depressed.
And I fall for it too. I fall for yeah. it too, right?
It's partly a code though, isn't it? It's partly like just a little bit of linguistic code we use between us, you know, with someone we don't know that well. Oh, yeah, the weather's this or that, you know, yeah, sort of.
It is linguistic code, but it goes to a fundamental truth, and we can laugh at it, which means that the truth that I'm getting at here is that feelings are an inside job. The external weather doesn't cause our internal mood, unless we have been grown up, unless we've grown up to believe that it's the truth, that miserable weather makes us miserable. But I've been happy in the sunshine, and I've been sad in the sunshine. Mm. I've been miserable in the sunshine. So it's cause and effect.
Mm. That's interesting, isn't it? Because when you use weather as an example, I absolutely get that. I'm someone that's actually quite miserable when it's boiling hot. I quite like the winter, to be honest. Now, if when it comes to feelings being an inside job, so we can only, you know, it's the weather inside us that dictates how we feel about the world and ourselves. What I'm thinking now about other external influences. So let's say, you know, a child is growing up with a violent parent or a parent who doesn't meet their needs. Surely you couldn't say to them, your feelings are an inside job.
Yes, I can.
So they're just not thinking about it positively enough. Or what's the...
No, I would never say that. I would never judge somebody else's thoughts or feelings. No, I wouldn't do that. I would explain the physics of it. I would explain the truth of it, the principle of it, right? And this is what I used to do. So before I came into the adoption space, like 4.5 years ago, I spent 6-7 years going into primary schools here and talking to kids about the fact, it is a fact, that feelings come from thoughts like juice comes from fruit. These were 8 to 11 year old kids, and they would cotton on very quickly through a workshop about confident coconuts that feelings are an inside job. It's adults have a far, far harder time grasping the truth than kids.
Mm.
It works like the metaphor that I came up with, right? So feelings come from thoughts like juice comes from fruit. If we're feeling sad, then some sad strawberry must have got into our juicer, and that's making us sad. Would we choose a sad strawberry? No. So we're off the hook, right? It's not our fault. It's not because we're not choosing our thoughts.
So going back to that retreat that you went to, and going through that process of realizing that the stories you've been telling yourself might not have been the whole truth.
Indeed. And the story that I'm not good enough being the central story.
Right.
Right. And the choosing thing, the choosing thing came from that, was inspired by the two people that led that retreat. Right. So we talk about their metaphor for it was the sausage machine. We get out of life what we put in. Yeah. If we want a pork sausage, assuming we're not, you know, kosher, right? If we want a pork sausage, what do we put in? Pork. But most of us don't choose our ingredient most of the time. What is choosing our ingredient most of the time? Our conditioning, what we've learned from others. So your authoritative Victorian granddad type person might have said, you've got to eat your greens. If you don't eat your greens, you won't grow up to be a strong woman. Or if you don't pay attention in school, you'll fail your exams and you won't get anywhere in life.
I don't think it's just the Victorian gentleman's spouting that one at the moment, to be honest, but that's another whole other
that's a societal thing. You know, most of us aren't choosing how we feel most of the time. We're not choosing what we do. We're not choosing what we say. We're being triggered. Everybody's being triggered. If you believe Facebook, every man on the planet is a narcissist. You know, everything's triggering. Oh, I was triggered by this. I was triggered by that. I was triggered by this. Well, how empowered is that?
Yeah.
We're giving our power away. We don't know about the fact that we're not choosing. We trust, we believe our inner critic. We don't realize it's a pack of lies that we've picked up.
So you've gone through a process to really identify that your inner critic was coming from an external source. It wasn't you. How hard has it been to sort of deconstruct everything after that, after realizing that?
Well, the process goes on.
Right.
18 years, I'm 58. That moment about the teddy bear happened when I was 40, so 18 years ago. You know, but there's been this big, there was a big shift moment about, I can't remember, probably 10 years ago. I got my adoption file, and it's very clear from a letter that's in there from my birth mother to the social worker that she loved me, that the teddy bear was not a consolation prize. It was a symbol of her love. And as I read that letter from her, I mean, she obviously never knew that I would see that letter. I mean, how could she have known it, writing it in February 1967, that I would get that file, whatever it was, 48 years later? She had no knowledge, but she was writing to the social worker. And as the tears flooded down my face when I felt her pain, I felt her powerlessness, I felt her desperation, I felt her grief, and I felt her love for me. And I realized without any doubt whatsoever that she loved me, and that thought that I had for 10, 15 seconds when I was 40, that she didn't love me enough to keep me, was complete and utterly wrong. So that's what I talk about. You know, you talk about hard-won wisdom. That came when I was in, like, I was breaking down in that moment. I was a mess. And yet I talk about the fact that at the age of 40, there was this eruption of anger. She didn't love me enough to keep me. Then there was the questioning of that, or that Sarah shared, that she didn't think that I was correct. The volcano stopped erupting, but there was still a little bit of white smoke coming out of the top, perhaps. And however many years later it was, 8-10 years later, when I got that adoption file, the tears basically extinguished that smoke from the volcano.
Right. So we hear commonly from adoptees and people working with adoptees, therapists and so on, that sometimes anger can really be, it's like the outward expression of pain and hurt.
Totally agree, yeah.
And experiencing that, really understanding that pain is some of the answer to dealing with the anger and the sometimes violence and such like.
How we feel.
Yeah.
Did you tell me that? I think I heard that recently from somebody. We behave how we feel.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's it. That's nailed it.
Yeah. Because there is a sort of a logic, isn't there, to my birth mother didn't keep me, therefore it must mean she didn't care, or, you know, whatever. There's blame there. I can see a logic in that. It's a very quick response. And it also is masking, isn't it? It's masking all that pain that is so hard to face. And the, you know, when you describe looking in your files and really, really connecting with your birth mother and what she must have been going through, it's a tragedy.
Yeah.
It sounds like just an enormous human tragedy. And it's not a tragedy you can simplify with, you know, it was that person's fault, or, you know.
It's not a logic, it's a feeling thing.
and becomes so complicated, doesn't it, as well, to pin down the reasons why she couldn't keep you, even though she possibly desperately wanted to, and the 1967.
She was disempowered, right? So she didn't have the abortion option, right? So abortion didn't become legal in not a legal abortion option anyway. Abortion didn't come legal in the UK until middle of 67 or so, and I was conceived 66, born early January 67. So she didn't have that. She didn't have that option. She was powerless. And in those days, you know, the single mums were very much frowned upon, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so the shame around that, and the difficulty in even financially supporting yourself, the practical side of it must have been impossible.
Well, it would, and it has, and it was for many birth mums. It was impossible. I don't think that would have been a challenge, you know, for Pat, for my birth mum. I think your parents would have supported her. But they were clearly, in those days, the perceived wisdom, is it still the case? I don't know. Was two parents is better than one. One parent's not right.
Yeah, and inverted commas, you're doing the best for the baby.
You're doing the best thing. You know, you're being selfless and all those sorts of stuff.
Yeah, so many myths, aren't there, tied up in that you hope we understand a lot more now about what babies need and supporting parents. And I guess also knowing where that isn't going to be good enough for a child's safety and welfare. Can I just ask you, Simon, about I've heard you, and you've talked a bit now about your podcast and the sort of vast range of experiences and stories that you've heard over the years from the adoption world. And sort of crudely, there's everything from adoption is wonderful and it's, you know, unicorns and rainbows and everything's brilliant, right through to the other end of the extreme, which is, you know, everybody is doomed by it, doomed by their trauma. Where would you say you sit on that scale, if that's not too simplistic a question?
Yeah, I would say that trauma is a psychological phenomenon, right? And different adoptees have different amounts of trauma. So to put it in the jargon of the adoptee space, adoption space, there is a continuum. There is no one primal wound. My own wound feels like a paper cut. Somebody else's wound, it might be slightly bigger, might feel like a, you know, a gash in their arm. They might just have to put some stereo strips on it. And then another further down the spectrum, somebody might feel like I cut my leg open once on some barbed wire jumping over a fence and had to have a couple of stitches. So that's it. And then further on, you've got, you know, some really extreme cases of kids who have, it's like the great white shark from Jaws, right? So there's a spectrum of size, right? If we shift metaphors, we can think of trauma as a coating of mud on a diamond. I didn't have much muck on my diamond. Somebody else might have 2 foot of muck, right? So, but the diamond is still the diamond.
Okay. So the muck doesn't penetrate the diamond then?
The muck doesn't penetrate the diamond. The muck doesn't identify the diamond. The muck disguises, conceals, veils the muck. So a different amount of people have different amount of muck. But my focus, the Thriving Adoptees logo, is a diamond.
Okay.
And it wasn't always that way, but it is now, right? So I'm not concerned about how much muck covers the diamond. I'm focused on the diamondness of our essential being underneath the muck.
Okay. So that's who you are as a person, aside from the trauma, who you are inside,
our essence,
and that bit that has not been ruined by trauma, no. Dirtied by it,
no.
Okay.
Trauma conceals our essence. Look at this in a slightly different way. So I saw this post on LinkedIn a couple of weeks ago, and it was the title for the post was "I am trauma." So this was from an adoptee. I did not respond to that post because I don't challenge people's views of the word. I don't challenge people's perspectives unless they ask me. However, I did decide that I was going to put my own take on that out into the world. And so I did, on, and I did this on Facebook and LinkedIn, right? So this, I'd like to read that to you if you're okay with that.
Okay, yeah, of course.
"We are not our trauma. We are what's aware of it. We are not our trauma. It comes and goes. We are what was there before and is left after. We are not our trauma. Before we are triggered, we are at peace. After the explosion fades, we are at peace. We are not our trauma. Trauma is a toxic cocktail of fear, shame, and grief. But we are the glass, not its content. We are not our trauma. We are the space it erupts in, not the eruption. We are not our trauma. It reverberates through our nervous system, but we are not the feeling. We are the one that feels it. We are not our trauma. Coming out of the fog revealed the storm of our trauma, but we are the sky, and the sky is untouched by the storm."
There's an awful lot of hope in there, isn't there?
Intentionally so.
In that message, yes. Because what it is indicating is that there is hope of a life. I mean, maybe for many people, it still has trauma's not going to magically go away, is it? It doesn't. It comes back and visits, and sometimes and haunts us. And
it comes back. Yeah, it
haunts all
us.
Of us.
The next element of the quote. But I changed it because I thought I didn't read that one out to you because I felt that the storm one really said it right. But here we go. Right, we are not our trauma. It sometimes plays out as a horror movie, but we are the screen the movie plays on, unscared. The screen isn't scared by the horror story, the horror movie. It comes and goes. We are the. It comes and goes. That's what it does. It's a felt thing. It's a felt thing, and feelings come and go. But we're the space in which those feelings come from, and it is intentionally about hope, and it's intentionally about the truth that trauma hides us, it doesn't harm us.
Do you think trauma can trick us into thinking that it is us?
Yes.
Powerful, isn't it? Hijacks.
It did. That it tricked that adoptee. The post said, "I am trauma."
Yeah. You are interested as well in, I mean, you've alluded to it earlier in our conversation, that the influences we surround ourselves in impact the way we think and our perceptions of the world. So it's like, you know, it's a bit like, you know, if you eat tons of chocolate and sugar, then you start to feel like you've eaten tons of chocolate and sugar. If you surround, you know, if you watch endless documentaries about serious crime, you know, if you're not careful, you can start to be brought down a bit by that. You know, if you surround yourselves by self with people who are endlessly negative, you know, it can start to colour the way you see the world.
Yeah. And it can reinforce, it tends to reinforce our beliefs.
Right. So like an echo chamber.
An echo chamber, exactly, right? So if we go back to what, I'm very worried about these echo chambers. Okay. And the reason I'm very worried about those echo chambers is I can see how my life would have gone differently had different people said different things to me, right? So I said to Sarah, not you, Sarah, when I was 40, she didn't love me enough to keep me. What was the teddy bear? A consolation prize. What if she hadn't, again, goosebumps, right? And my body knows, the body keeps the score. My body knows that I'm about to share something big. What if she'd said to me, "Oh, you poor soul, Simon. Oh, that must have been horrible for you. Oh, you know, she should have stood up to her parents. She should have kept you. She shouldn't. You shouldn't be feeling this way. I'm so sorry that you feel this way. Right? Mm. I could have gone down a lifetime of a second lifetime, I was 40 at the time, right, a second half of my life, blaming my birth mother. If she had validated, but she didn't, she invalidated. She said, I don't think it was quite, I'm a mum, Simon, and I don't think it was quite like that. Mm. I don't think it would have been quite like that.
So there might be a different way to see this.
There might be it's like a nudge.
Yeah.
It was a nudge. And but my thought was new, so it was nudgeable.
Yeah.
If my thought was old, if that thought had been going on for me for 30 years, it wouldn't have been nudgeable. Not in the simple thing. She challenged it, and I saw that my words were wrong. And then 10 years later, I had cast iron proof reading that.
Yes.
Right. So it's invalidation. I've not had a lot of therapy. I don't know how many hours therapy, 20 hours, how many hours coaching have I had? How many hours reading books about, you know, beliefs and these different things? Tens of thousands of hours. You know, I listen to the stuff when I'm walking the dog, when I'm in the car, listen to the podcast. Right. Yeah. So I've had all that coaching, and coaching is about it's about coming to a different perspective. It's about seeing through our beliefs, right? There was I talk about this quite a lot, but I'm not a Gabor Mate fan. He's a trauma. Have you come across Gabor Mate? Trauma.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of his because I just think it's basically sounds like an advert for him. He doesn't prompt a lot of insights in me. So anyway, but he prompted a huge one for me last year. He had this course called The Gift of Trauma. And I thought, The Gift of Trauma? Wow. Talk about repositioning it, right? But if you think about it, right, a lot of adoptive parents have been through infertility and they've adopted because of that. They've had, I think, miscarriages, as there must be. Absolute nightmare. Right? You hear of mums having to give birth to babies that have already died and stuff, like wrenches my soul apart, right? But what if your trauma, if the trauma that you've been through allows you to understand your kid's trauma? That's a gift, right? When I did that, when I used to do the stuff in schools, I shared how being bullied, and I wasn't bullied because I was adopted, right? It was other stuff. I had buck teeth, all sorts of things. Didn't drink tea on scout camp. I've lost my thread there.
So you were explaining to children.
Yeah, gift, yeah. Right? So it's a gift. Trauma as a gift, as in our trauma helps us understand other people's trauma. And empathy is lubricates the oil of communication and relationships, doesn't it? I mean, it's key, that understanding. And without our trauma, then we can't relate to other people that have trauma. So there's something even bigger than that. You know, this Gabor Mate said, it said the gift of trauma, and then underneath it said, feeling not good enough is not a feeling, it's a belief. And I'm thinking, that's brilliant, right? Because it's really hard to change feeling, it's easier to change beliefs. So then again, we've got that message of hope. What we're trying to do, what all my training and all my podcasts is to, you know, when I'm doing guesting like this, right? I had this huge moment on this topic, interviewing a woman, an adoptee in the States who had adopted, right? So she's an adoptee, she's adopted mom, if you want to marry full American, right? And we were talking about self-esteem and being good enough and all that sort of stuff. And something I said something like, you know, we need to see our value so that we can point others to theirs. Mm-hmm. And it clicked for her. She realized what I was talking about with this diamondness, right? So the clearer a diamond, the more that it's worth, the more clearly we can see our own diamond, the higher our self-worth, and the higher our self-worth, the better we're going to be at pointing our kids to see their infinite worth. If we can't share what we don't have, if we don't have high regard for ourselves, then how are we going to help our kids and teens, you know, see, when I say kids, I mean all ages, right? Whether they're 10, 15, 58, like me, whatever, right? We can't share what we don't have. We can't point to something that we haven't seen for ourselves.
And it's interesting, isn't it, Renee? Because I'm an adoptive parent myself, and certainly I identify with having learned an enormous amount about trauma. It's completely rewired how I see the world and how I see other people, my relationships. And in that sense, yeah, it has. It's hard to say it's a gift, isn't it? Because it's such a hard gift.
It is.
It's terrible. But actually, you know, when you come out the other side of some of this stuff, you can look back and think, yeah, I've grown through this in ways that I would not have done had I not had this experience. And then when you then look at your children, your family, there's no way you'd ever say to young people, you are your trauma. You are almost desperate to help them see how brilliant they are, how much potential they've got, you know, that they're not their exam results or what's happened to them or what they earn or not or don't earn or whatever. I think that can give us a kinder perspective on ourselves as well. Like, you wouldn't say that to your children or to young people in your life. Why would you say it to yourself?
You'd only say it to yourself if you weren't choosing.
Yeah.
And you're the hearer, not the voice. You know, this stuff has infinite depth, I used to think knowledge was yes or no, right? And we're brought up on that, aren't we? Right?
Yeah.
Do you know, Simon, do you know the formula for the area of a circle? Pi r squared. Is that right? Pi r squared. So I either know that or, in terms of seeing our diamond, that's not a one or a zero. That's an infinite, you know. I talk about the, you know, if, as you gathered, you know, I'm all about metaphors. We can only wrap our heads around something that is concrete, right? So that's why all the metaphors. I think of, you know, another metaphor for insight or a shift. You talked about shifts in perspective or getting a new perspective or those sort of words you've been talking about. Well, think of it this way, right? The penny is dropping down a well and there's no bottom to that.
Yeah, we're on a lifelong journey, aren't we?
We're on a lifelong journey, and there's two sides to this penny dropping thing, right? A lifelong journey to me means the pennies keep dropping, and they keep, and the same, so different pennies keep dropping. We have new insights, and then the pennies keep dropping. The same penny keeps dropping deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. So for me, I talked about the lady, the volunteer at the swimming pool, who believes that the outside world determines our internal world. After I've had that little, seen her stuff again, I go into the swimming pool and I see the lanes busy, and that cheeses me off, right? So in that moment, I'm not seeing my lack of choice. I'm not seeing the fact that my feelings, my impatience as a stronger swimmer comes from me, not comes from this busy lane, right? So I'm not superhuman. I am learning, but hopefully I see that more of the time. So I have less road rage these days, for example. But sometimes I still get impatient in a traffic jam. So it's about, did you use the word grace? I used the word grace.
Sounds too clever a word for
humility.
Me, to be honest. I think it was
humility.
Your Simon. Humility, yes.
Use the word humility, right? I think grace and, for me, grace and humility are quite, they're in the same, sorry, I spend a lot of time with Americans, ballpark, right? So it's grace for ourselves. You know, I'm not saying you should choose to see your diamondness, Sarah. No, I'm not saying that. I came up with this little saying about 4 years ago, so still keep using it, right? There's no such thing as a second-hand insight. We have to have them for ourselves. We can't give our kids the sight of their diamondness. We can just point them towards it, and we hope at some point they will see it, and they'll see it more deeply, and see it more deeply, and see it more deeply. And that's the challenge.
Simon, I just want to return briefly back to what you were saying about echo chambers. And if at that point in your life where, you know, you were saying to Sarah, oh, my birth mother, she, you know, just give me this teddy bear as a consolation prize. And if she at that point had chosen to say, yeah, you're right, you know, it was what a terrible person she was and poor you, how that could have like really led you down a road that maybe didn't lead, certainly didn't lead to the diamond anyway.
No, it would have led to, I would be concentrating on the manure rather than the diamond that's within.
Yeah, and that's quite alluring, isn't it? It's almost, I kind of, you know, I think we probably all feel ourselves attracted down that route sometimes of maybe, I'm just speaking for myself here, victimhood and being able to blame someone for how you feel is quite satisfying, isn't it? I quite enjoy that sometimes, but it doesn't lead anywhere. It's a bit like the sort of sirens singing this attractive song, but actually it leads you onto the rocks.
Drown.
Yeah. So I'm kind of imagining that, like, when you were 40, at that point, if you'd been immersed in, say, certain parts of social media, or you'd been surrounded by people who reinforced that view of your birth mother, how much more difficult it might have been to accept that nudge from Sarah and start to see your birth mother as a person who was a victim of the circumstances she was in at that time, with all the cultural and societal baggage that she was landed with.
Yeah. So first thing is, you know, we can, there's two sides to it. She didn't love me, right? So I'm projecting my pain on her. I'm the victim who wasn't loved enough, right? And but the other message is if I'm taking it internally, I am unlovable, right? So there's two ways it can go, right?
Yeah.
Projected outside or internalized. So luckily Sarah said that, chat invalidated me, right? She didn't invalidate me. She just shared. See, that's the thing, right? She could say she just shared her opinion, right? And I took that on board somehow, you know, my wisdom in the moment, right? A bit, probably about, I don't know, 8 years or later, you know, like I was struggling with some stuff, and somebody recommended the Primal Wound for me. And I read the Primal Wound, and because I'm quite susceptible, I was brought up very honest. So I tend to believe other people because I've been told that people are honest and so, right? I felt it took me down, that Primal Wound book took me down until, and I believed I was wounded. I hadn't believed I was wounded till I read the Primal Wound. So that's how susceptible and sensitive I can be, right? But I was hanging around in some online kind of personal development and circles, and was having a mentor session one day, and I had this, you know, the big epiphany moment, right? That our essence is unwoundable. I am unwounded. I thought I was wounded. I realized I'm not wounded. And I realized I'm not wounded because I realized we are all unwoundable.
Okay. So you sort of surrounded yourself, or you found yourself with enough people around you, enough influences to help you get to that point.
Yes. So I was in a development, a coaching, spending time with coaches, spending time with other people who were looking to move on. Right.
Yeah.
What I wasn't doing is I wasn't going into groups on social media where lots of other people congregate, lots of adoptees congregate to talk about their wounds. I didn't do that. Those spaces weren't available, I don't think, when that happened.
No.
But if I'd gone into, if those spaces had been available and I'd gone into those places would have taken me down. Now, when I say we are unwoundable, people often look at me like I'm slightly mad, because we've gone from this rainbow and unicorns version of adoption until the Primal Wound, which Nancy Verrier, an adoptive mum, wrote was published in 1993. And so people look at me slightly mad because that is the perceived wisdom. So after Nancy Verrier, we've had all the other trauma stuff come out, all the other trauma books, the Bessel van der Kolk, Body Keeps the Score, all those things, right? So what changed it for me in terms of, I think, in terms of my ability to communicate that is we can look at trauma and healing and that stuff on two levels, not just one, right? We can look at it on two levels. So the first level, I would say psychologically. Psychologically, we've all had trauma. And if we go down a healing route, you know, if we decide that we want to go down a healing route, we will be healing forever, which means we'll be constantly looking for, we'll continue to look for penny drop moments, hanging around. I talk about hanging around in the bus stop, hanging around at the bus stop to coordinate them into, to put those into the same metaphor, right? That could be about standing by the well, you know, waiting for things to drop. But those
you're open to see those moments, right?
And clearly, as an aside here, we talk a lot about in kind of adoptive parent circle, we talk about kids being you know, they've been triggered, their frontal lobe is shut down, they're dysregulated, right? That's closed in that moment when any of us are dysregulated.
Yeah.
Insights aren't going to occur in those in those moments, right? So the lifelong learning is the fact that more pennies dropping, and more those pennies keep dropping, keep on going down and down. But in those spaces, online where adoptees gather to share, to talk about wounds, they reinforce the wound. They reinforce one another. And if I'd been in those spaces would have taken me down rather than lifting me up. So we can look at healing. On one level, we'll be healing forever psychologically, but at a deeper, more essential level, we are whole because we are not wounded. We are unwounded because our essence is unwoundable, our essence. Yeah. So what we're distinguishing here is we're just seeing, you know, trauma is largely a felt thing, right? It's felt in the body. We are separating how we feel from who we are, which is back to the bit before.
Okay.
We are not our trauma. Trauma conceals the truth of who we are. Trauma hides us. It doesn't harm us.
So this is a great time to come back to your book, Simon. So as a reminder, this is your project to crowdsource like wisdom held in the adoption community.
Yeah.
Learned through life experience, often hard learned. And this is your way of sort of countering those echo chambers, offering hope to people.
Yes.
Thinking about that diamond.
Yes.
So for everyone listening now, so this is the summer of 2025 that we're recording this. You would like to gather as many accounts as you can by, yes. When would you like people to respond to you?
By 31st of August.
Right. So by the 31st of August. So that gives you 6 weeks if you're listening. Well, by the time we get this podcast up, maybe 5 weeks, but it gives you a good amount of time to give Simon, not a great long. You don't need to write a long treatise. It's sort of 250-ish words. Is that right?
Yeah, between 50 and 250 words.
Okay. And you can be anyone in the adoption community. So from an adoptee, birth parent, adopted parent, professional as well. So there's a Google form on our show notes. We will also put your website, the link to your website as well, which is thrivingadoptees.com. So Simon, I would just like to thank you for a really fascinating conversation. I hope I've kept up with you.
Brilliantly. You know, I think, you know, I'm all about insights, but sometimes people want strategies. The reason for the book is to make things more practical and to give a bigger, more rounded view of how we can help our adopted kids thrive, how we can help our kids thrive as adopters. I'm looking for the practical of the works as well as the insights and the perspective shifts that we've been talking about today, Sarah.
So tell Simon what has worked for you, and yeah. All that will come out in your book. And I hope you'll consider coming back on the podcast when you've published it to talk more about it.
I'd be delighted to do so. And just a couple of things. This isn't a money-making venture. The book will be free. The ebook will be free. We're going to have to charge for the paper version, because you can't give that stuff away for free. If the people that contribute towards the book in terms of the text, the wisdom that they share, they also vote for, they nominate a post-adoption charity that they want any profits from the printing book to go to. So this isn't about me making money. This is about me giving back to the adopted community and aligned with my aim to help everybody thrive.
Great. Lovely. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.
The Family Matters podcast is brought to you by Adoption UK. You can listen on all major platforms. Please subscribe to receive the latest episodes and to help us to explore and share many more interesting and important subjects. That's all for this episode, and thank you for listening.